Hi, this is Allison, producer here at On My Mind. Today's episode is a conversation from the archives in honor of Women's History Month with legendary broadcaster Barbara Walters. She died in December at age 93. Walters joined Diane in the studio in 2008, shortly after the release of her memoir titled Audition. She talked about the challenges of her childhood and her status as a pioneer in the industry. Walters told Diane that she wasn't deliberately paving the way, but when treated unfairly, she was simply saying, quote, "You cannot do this to me because I'm a woman." The interview has been edited for length and clarity.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. Barbara Walters says young people starting out in television often say to her, "I want to be you." She always replies, "Then you have to take the whole package." Most people know her as a groundbreaking journalist and one of the most famous interviewers on television. Now, for the first time, she's unwrapping the whole package in a new memoir titled Audition. She talks openly about her public and her private life, and she joins me in the studio. We'll take your calls throughout the hour. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Barbara Walters, welcome.
Thank you so much, Diane.
So
very happy to be
you.
Here.
Thank you. I understand that one day your book shot up to number one at every retail outlet in the country, including Amazon.com. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm sort of amazed and thrilled.
You know, I think it is because people want to know you. I think that that's the reason.
Well, you know, over the years, I think people get an impression, they do of you, they do of me, that we are so much in command and that our lives are very different from theirs, that... You know, most people struggle, especially most women. And the feeling is that my life was just one big glorious life, and now on The View, everything is hunky-dory and so forth. And I wanted people to be able to relate to this, and I think maybe that's why it's successful. It's not, then I interviewed.
Exactly.
I think that's a bore, although the celebrities are in it, and the murderers are in it, and the presidents are in it, and et cetera. But I think my own struggles and mistakes and relationship with my daughter and with my sister and my parents, I think that I hope that people can relate to that and to see that we've all bled. And my story, I hope, will be a good read, but I also hope that people can relate to it and perhaps make them feel better about their own lives. They're not alone.
Exactly. I feel that reading the book, I found it to be so accessible and personal in how you relate the story. You say that you almost titled it Sister. Now, tell us about your sister, because she's such an important part of your life.
Well, I think my sister was the most influential part of my life. Influential in a strange way. She was 3.5 years older than I. I could not have written this book if my sister was still alive. She's not. She died of ovarian cancer. But she was what they called, back then, mentally retarded. rather a harsh title. She also had a terrible stutter, so that when she opened her mouth, people made fun of her. And she was very isolated. People made fun of her. People made fun of me. And I
loved
her. Because
you were her sister.
Because I was her sister. My first memory is of our going outside in the street and a bunch of little boys chasing us and ridiculing her. And we ran into the house in tears. Well, I loved her. She was my sister. But I hated her.
Of course.
I mean, I said this in the book, and then I felt so awful. I erased it, and then I thought, no, this is the way I felt. And I was torn with guilt. She was my sister. She was my older sister. But she also taught me compassion. I knew at some point in my life that she would be my responsibility, that I would have to support her. That made a difference, Diane. That meant I had to work. But my sister and my relationship with her was the most influential part of my childhood.
You did not, perhaps, start out writing this book this way.
No.
How did you conceive it at first, and how did it change?
Well, I had left 2020 4 years ago, the news magazine that I had been on for 25 years, because I felt I'd done everything that I could do on it, and I didn't have the kind of variety of guests that I wanted anymore. It was movie stars who had come out of rehab, and I thought I'd done it. I'd really done enough of that. And so I thought, I'm going to have some time. I will take Spanish lessons. I will go to museums. I will do what so many of us yearn to do. And then the publishers came and said, well, you know, you're going to have this time. Why don't you write a book? And I really did think, Diane, that I was going to write a book about my sister and my father and mother. And it would be a small book. I would call it Audition, because I felt I'd been auditioning my whole life. And that I would write about my childhood, my exotic, glamorous, but difficult childhood. I would write about my experiences on television, which were so tough for women and so tough for me. And I would write it up until my success on 2020, and it would be a small book, and I would be very happy. Well, then the publisher said, people want to know about the murderers, and the presidents, and Monica Lewinsky, and the heads of state, and the celebrities, and I'm not blaming the publishers, they were right. So the book got bigger and bigger until it's now more than 600 pages.
Last question about your sister. Did you ever find out what it was?
No. No, because in those days, there was not that kind of understanding. When my parents went to some doctors, they said, send her away. And we never knew. There were not workshops. There were very few of them then. There were only beginning to be places for adults when my sister was older. At one point, she worked for a place in Florida called the Hope School. I think they're still open, which was a place that did have young people like herself, but that was relatively recent, and so many parents worried, as my parents did, what would happen when they were gone, who would take care of their daughter, and their feeling was that I would, and I knew I would, and I knew I had to, but a part of me resented that it was that, from the time I was a child, that weight on my life. And I named my baby Jackie after my sister because I loved my sister and I wanted her to feel that she too had a baby.
This title, Audition, sort of runs through the whole book. There is this sense of insecurity. There is this sense of, I'm not good enough, can't do it, but I've got to do it. I know the feeling well. I think probably there are a lot of people who know the feeling well. Tell us about your first foray into the world of television.
Well, my father, who had been enormously successful in show business, owned at one point the three greatest nightclubs in America. They were called the Latin Quarter, Lou Walters Latin Quarter, one in Boston, where I was born, one in Florida and Miami, and one in New York. And he had tremendous ups and downs. I mean, we lived in penthouses. There was all the money. And then when I was in my 20s, my father lost it all and had a very, very tragic and difficult time. And it was at that point that I had to support my mother, my father, my sister, and my daughter. And look, most men and so many women today have to do jobs they don't like because they got to earn a living. And I did. And I began as a writer in television. I never thought I'd be in front of the cameras. I wasn't beautiful. I didn't speak that well, so on. And I got, I'm making this a little short, but I got hired by accident on the Today Show because the woman who was on it, who was named Maureen O'Sullivan, the mother of Mia Farrow, just couldn't hack it. So they let her go, and they put me on the air for 13 weeks at the minimum salary, and I stayed on for 13 years. Yes, and I had a wonderful time on the Today Show.
But you also had, you experienced a good bit of resistance.
Yes, I did. And I was not only auditioning in my private life to have friends and to belong and because I always felt like an outsider, especially because of my father's business. It seemed so glamorous, but it wasn't to my mother and me.
You were talking about the ups and downs financially in your father's life, having owned these three really outstandingly famous nightclubs, and then all of a sudden you had to become the bread earner. What happened to your father during those years?
My father was a gambler by nature. He took great risks. He was a superb producer. He was a bad businessman. I mean, he did these gorgeous, glorious shows. I knew every celebrity, Frank Sinatra and Milton Berle and Sophie Tucker. On the surface, it was wonderful. But my father had a partner that he really had tremendous problems with. And at one point, he sold all the Latin Quarters, opened two new nightclubs, one in Florida, one in New York, and they both went bust. And my father lost everything and was in great despair, and we didn't know it. And he attempted suicide from an overdose of sleeping pills. I told the columnist, because my father knew
all
the columnists,
Walter
Winchell, that my father had a heart attack, and I protected his reputation all these years, and it's not that I want to diminish his reputation because I learned to appreciate how special he was, but I felt it was nobody's business. And I wrote about it now again because I thought people have got to understand. They don't have to understand, but I'd like them to understand what I went through.
What was the relationship between your mother and father? That couldn't have been easy.
It was not a good relationship. I loved my mother very dearly. My mother was the one who was always with us, who got up in the morning to make us breakfast no matter what, so on. But my father, you know, my mother wanted a nice, stable life, and we always worried that my father was going to lose it all. Even in my years in the Today Show, my mother worried, I would worry, that it was going to be over tomorrow. And I think it's taken me almost until very recently that I felt financially secure and that I felt a kind of peace of mind about this, you know, so-called wondrous career. But even on the Today Show, which gave me such an opportunity. Whoever thought this was going to happen? And they were paying me $750 a week. Can you imagine? $750 a week.
Big deal.
But Hugh Downs, who was the host of the program, put me on the air and was wonderful, terrific to me. We had a great, great relationship. When he left, a newsman named Frank McGee came on. Didn't want to do the Today Show. He'd been doing the evening news. Thought this was a come down. Certainly didn't want to work with some girl who, in the beginning on the Today Show, I could only do the girly features, fashion shows, celebrity interviews. Now I was doing some news, and he certainly didn't want that. And he went all the way up to the president of NBC News and said, and Diane, it's as if I'm talking about, you know, 1868, 1870, not 1970, and said she can only come in after I've asked three questions because I am the newsman.
Wow.
And he was very difficult to work with. It didn't show on camera. but it certainly, it was very painful.
Well, but Barbara Walters, you have chutzpah. You have that strength in your gut, even though you doubted yourself along the way. You've got to have that to do what you've done.
First of all, I had to work. That makes a difference.
Right.
You know, I was unhappy, but, you know, I wasn't going to stay home, and I wasn't very good at marriage. So I just couldn't rely on the husband. But, I mean, at that point, when it went up to the president of the whole company, and he said, okay, well, originally I wasn't supposed to even ask any questions.
Right.
And then I said, you can't do this to me. After all that I've done here, I don't know whether it was chutzpah or whether it was, you know, how dare you be so unfair? How can you do this to me? And there were very few women. I had no mentors. I mean, I wasn't deliberately paving the way. I was just saying, you cannot do this to me because I'm a woman. So the solution was, fine, let Frank McGee ask three questions. You can come in on the fourth. Hard to believe today, isn't it?
And how long did that last?
It lasted until Frank died, which was 2 years before I left NBC. And it was only when Frank died, because it had been written into my contract, if anything happened to the host, I would be co-host. And NBC then was forced to make me co-host. And ever since, on every morning show and on all of the other programs in which there's a woman, she is the co-host. I'm very, very proud of that. It was an auxiliary contribution, but it made a difference, and I'm so proud of it.
I must say, you faced the same kind of resentment when you went to ABC and began to co-host the evening news.
Well, that was an enormous jump for me, to leave ABC, where I was happy and doing well on the Today Show, and to leave NBC and
right,
to go to ABC.
Right.
And I did it because after 13 years of getting up at 4:30 in the morning, I thought, I can have a normal life. I had a 7-year-old child. I can go out to dinner. But I also felt, what an opportunity. And I was not a great risk taker, but I guess I was more than I thought.
More than you thought.
When I went there to be the first female co-anchor of a network news program, I went with a man named Harry Reisner, who had been doing it alone. And like Frank McGee, he did not want a partner. He was very difficult to me on and off the air, but much worse than that, it was that the program was failing. And I knew it. You could feel on the air that we were uncomfortable. Viewers didn't want to watch. And what saved me, Diane, was hundreds of letters from women saying, we're going through the same thing. We're not on the air. We're not on television. But we're going through this in our careers. And hang in there. If you can make it, we can make it.
And now you see Katie Couric repeating history.
I feel for Katie. The difference is, I think, that Katie didn't have a partner who was also so hard on her. She didn't have to fight that.
Right.
And when she left NBC, they were wonderful and warm to her. They were not to me. When she came to CBS, she was greatly welcomed. My arrival was not greeted with the greatest affection by the affiliates. They didn't understand. But I certainly can relate to what Katie's going through. She'll survive. She'll be okay.
Do you think she made a mistake leaving
NBC? I talked
to
Katie recently, and I said, do you mind leaving? Because for so many years, I felt I'd made a mistake. And Katie said no, that she did not feel that she had made a mistake.
But now there is talk of removing her.
I don't know how she feels now.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's been difficult for her, but Katie is a fine reporter, and I think that she will find a new route for herself. In my case, a man named Lou Knowledge, who was a brilliant man, came in and became the head of ABC News, sent Harry back to CBS, and I then went off and did the most important interviews of my life.
Barbara.
And then I did specials, and they saved me.
Now a quick break. Thank you.
Hi, it's Diane. Join me for my next book club event, a conversation with Sheila Johnson. She's co-founder of BET, all about her memoir, Walk Through Fire. That's coming up Wednesday, April 24th at 6 p.m. Eastern. Find out more. Register at dianereem.org/book club.
And we're back. Here's the rest of Diane's 2008 conversation with Barbara Walters.
I want to ask you about your daughter, about whom you have talked a great deal in this book for the first time. It's not been easy.
Well, I said that I hope that people could relate to this. I think there are so many parents who are having difficulties with their children. These are very hard times to raise children, especially
Absolutely. Teenagers.
And my daughter, who was adopted, who always felt inadequate because of that, she feels that most adopted children have a kind of what she called black hole in their heart. And
she was adopted during your first marriage. Or your second?
She was adopted during my second marriage.
Second.
My first marriage was very brief.
I see.
And I was quite young. Her father was Lee Goober, who has since died. And we wanted her enormously. And when she was in her very early teens, she began to rebel. And she was later on drugs, which I didn't know. And those times, we didn't know that much. And we went through a terrible time. And I finally sent her to what was called an emotional growth school. It was the most painful thing I ever did. She had run away from home. I mean, I was desperate. And I was on the air, smiling,
and you were on
talking,
the air,
doing
of
interviews,
course.
Traveling.
Of course.
But and this was the hardest chapter for me to write. And I wrote it because my daughter said, Mom, write this. People have to know that if we went through this and made it, that other people can. And today, she runs a therapeutic wilderness program in Maine called New Horizons. She said, everything I put you through, Mom, you know, I understand these kids, and she understands their parents. It's very supportive. It's not one of these places where you march for 3 miles with a bag, with a, you know, pack in your bag, and then they give you a glass of water. It's structured and supportive, and it comes from her own experience and wonderful therapist. Well, what a happy ending. But it was the most difficult time of my life.
And was your mother still alive and seeing all
yes,
this?
Yes, but my mother adored her. My mother could see no wrong. And my sister Jackie, and Jackie named after my sister Jackie. I mean, this was a family that just, I mean, when she was born, it was no adopted, not adopted. It was the only grandchild. My mother could see no wrong. I wish she had known how it all turned out.
How often are you able to see Jackie?
I just saw her. She came to New York very recently. She doesn't like New York. She likes the quiet of Maine. She likes the outdoor life. We talk all the time. We've learned over the years not to push each other's buttons. We're very accepting of each other's lives. I learned a lot. When she was at this emotional growth school, parents came up, and I went all the time, all the time. And I learned myself mistakes that I had made. And one of the things that happened there was that Jackie had to be totally honest, and I was shocked. I was miserable, but I began to understand. So we live very different lives. She's also very funny. At one point, I said to her, she never wanted to find her biological mother. And I thought, maybe she did and just didn't want to hurt me. So I talked to her about it one day when she was in her 20s. And I said, if you want me to do this, I will try to find who it is. And she said, I've had so much trouble with you. Why would I want another one?
Barbara, if you had not had that life, do you think you would have found the strength to be who you are today?
I think for many women, it's a balancing act to struggle with the career and the marriage and the child Now, if I had not had the financial problems, maybe when things got really tough, I would have said, I'm going to go home to Mommy and Daddy, back to the penthouse.
Right.
I don't know where drive comes from. I don't know where ambition comes from.
Courage.
Maybe courage.
Courage.
Maybe whatever I did, I had to do it the best. I did more homework than was necessary. I probably, you know, to get the big get, all that competition, which thank goodness I don't have to do. Do you not understand that?
Am I talking to
the converted? You know, I don't know where it comes from. And I don't know that everybody has to have a career. I'm not sure you do.
Absolutely.
You know, you can have the most fulfilled life, maybe more so, with your family or doing volunteer work if you're able to. I don't think a career is for everyone.
You pay a price. Absolutely. For years, your friends have wondered about your relationship with Roy Cohen. He was counsel to Joe McCarthy, and at least from those of us who saw him from the outside, not a particularly likable person. What did you find in that relationship?
Well, when I first met him, because I met him through my father when he came to the Latin Quarter in Florida, he was at the height of his notoriety, and my father said, "This is my daughter. She said she wanted to meet you." And I said, "I never wanted to meet him. I thought he was vile. I'd watched the Army McCarthy hearings." When I came to New York, he called me several times and wanted to have dinner. Now, Roy, eventually, I think people knew that he was a homosexual. I don't think he had admitted it to himself in those days. But at a certain point, I began to see him now and then. I was working for a public relations firm called Tex McCrary, Inc., named after a journalist named Tex McCrary. And my boss, by the way, at that time was Bill Sapphire.
Who also told you what? What did Bill Sapphire say to you about your gifts, about your talent, about...
Well, nobody thought that I should go on the air.
Right.
No, nobody thought that
should
happen.
And Bill was one of them.
Okay. But that's when I learned to write and really so forth. Anyway, and Roy Cohn brought some accounts to that public relations firm, for which I was grateful. But what happened, and I have been severely criticized by my friends, and I can understand, because Roy did some terrible things. But when my father lost everything, he also had not paid his taxes in New York. And my mother called me and said, "Your father can't come to New York, and if he does, he will be arrested." And I remember just after I had talked to my mother, my phone rang, and it was Roy Cohn. And I would never have told him this, but I was in tears. And he said, "Don't worry about it.
I'll take care of it.
I will take care of it." I don't know how he did it. I don't know what judges he talked to. Roy had a lot of power. I just know that the charges were dropped. And as I've said in the book, I forgot about ethics. This was my father. And I was loyal to Roy. And I know people didn't understand it. And this is the first time I've ever written about it. This was my father, and he saved him.
Barbara Walters is with me. Her book titled Audition, a Memoir, is already number one everywhere, but I assure you it is a fascinating insight into a woman we've all known or thought we knew and now can truly understand. Let's go first to Howard in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Howard. You're on the air.
Hello, Barbara. This is Howard Royce from Jacksonville, Florida. And my question for you is, had you ever met Gilda Radner? And if you had, what did you think about becoming part of an iconic show, at least a character, when Gilda would impersonate you on Saturday Night Live? I'm curious about that on a more, you know, less serious note than what you've been speaking about today.
Yeah, well, there's a lot in the book that's not that serious, but I watched Gilda doing wah, 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 and I hated it. And it was my daughter who said to me, because she was watching it, I don't know what she was doing up so late, but she said, you know, Oh, Mommy, lighten up. And then I did meet Gilda, and she was a little nervous about meeting me.
I'll bet.
We met at some, I don't know, you know, big dinner, and I said, Gilda, do me. And she did. And she looked the way I looked, and she sat the way I sat. And it turned out that we had the same makeup person when we were at NBC.
Who really?
Said, this is the way Barbara sits, and this is the way she looks. And then we could laugh together and feel good together. And when she died, I wrote to her husband, Gene Wilder, and I said, she made me laugh. I will miss her.
Oh, you know, I had Gene Wilder on this program. We talked about Gilda, and we talked about that episode, and he is so darling.
Yes, he is.
He's just a lovely man.
But you know, when they make fun of you, listen, everybody says that they make fun of you on Saturday Night Live, it's the greatest compliment. Yeah, well.
Well, here's what I want to ask you. On television, unlike radio, I mean, people don't see me. And that's great.
They should see you. You're beautiful.
Thank you so much. I love being behind this microphone and in this studio. Women on television have got to stay youthful looking. What did that mean for you?
Well, you know, and I will answer you, I look at Hillary Clinton and I think, how does she do it every day? You know, she has to get up, do her hair, which looks good. She has to be careful the roots don't show. She has to put contact lenses in because she, you know, actually wears very thick glasses. She has to do the makeup. For me, I have gone blonder and blonder. When you look at early pictures, especially in the book, I have very dark hair.
Dark hair,
yeah.
Right.
I do have a wonderful hairstylist named Bryant Renfro. He's only been with me like 25 years. And a superb makeup person named Laurie Klein. They're both with me today. That's why, don't you think I look good?
I think you look great. Yeah,
because I have them.
I think you look great.
But I do know how to do my own makeup. And then we have all of these things today that we didn't have. We have Botox and we have fillers, so you don't have to get your face lifted. I mean, occasionally people say to Laurie Klein, who does my makeup, well, when did Barbara have her face done? And Laurie said, when do you think she has time? But, I mean, we have all of these things you can do now that you couldn't do. So we can stay much younger. But, you know, there still is. A man can get as old as he wants on television.
Isn't
I mean, you can look
something?
At Mike Wallace and,
isn't
you know,
that
nobody
something?
Cares. Molly Safer, who cares?
Yeah.
But for the women, they still do care. You still have to look good. And I think about that. And I know for a lot of reasons that I'm not going to work forever in front of the cameras.
And you're now doing radio on Sirius.
Ah, listen, that may be the future. I'll never be what you are, but, you know, that may be the future. But part of it is, you know, you don't want to become, oh, look at her, which they, with it all, they never say to a man. I never hear them
never.
Say to a man, my goodness, doesn't he look old? Yeah. Nothing.
Yeah.
You know,
isn't that something?
Yeah, I'm always, you know, the most important thing, not the makeup, but I'll tell all the women at home, the lighting, and make sure it's directly on your face and not the overhead lights, which we have here, by the way. Terrible lighting in here.
Let's go to JD, who's here in Washington. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a short anecdote that I would like to tell about Ms. Walters.
All right.
A long time ago, over 20 years ago, I was a secretary, and I worked for an attorney who was representing Ferdinand Marcos. And one day, Ms. Walters called to talk to the attorney, and he wasn't there, and so I answered the phone. I was so impressed at Ms. Walters' calm, generous nature when she talked to me on the phone. She made her own phone call. It wasn't some secretary calling to talk to some other secretary. It was Miss Walters. And she was lovely to me on the phone.
And wasn't I lucky? Can you imagine if I had, you would have made this call today and said, Miss Walters called and I did make my own phone. And gee, she was awful. And this program is live and there was nothing I could have done about it. So thank you for this call.
Well, thank you for treating me so nicely.
All right, JD, I'm awfully glad you called. Let's go now to West Bloomfield, Michigan. Good morning, Annie. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning.
If you don't mind, I want to go back to your sister, Jackie, for a moment. I have a 24-year-old son with severe autism, and I want to make a couple of points. First, I want you to know that I call him my accidental teacher. And I do that because, looking back, I realize he taught me more than anyone, and ironically, without, you know, intending to. And then also, my son, being the oldest child, it took me 7 years to decide to have a second child. And when we decided to go ahead and have a second child, despite doctors telling us that we had a 25% chance of recurrence, I immediately said, if I have a second, I have to have a third. And my rationale was that my husband and I had to share the responsibility of my son, and I felt that I didn't want just one child to have to shoulder the entire responsibility, although there were no guarantees that either of them would be normal, but thankfully they did turn out to be healthy, normal children.
I'm glad.
Well, I think it was a courageous and wonderful decision, and obviously it's a decision that you and your husband share. And I, too, learned from my sister, as difficult as it was. I did learn compassion, and I did learn to understand so much more about families than I would have if it had just been myself and growing up, you know, with brothers and sisters who had no difficulties.
Barbara, another element in the book that you know full well has been raising eyebrows since the book came out was your revelation that you had an affair with Edward Brooke, who was at the time member of Congress, and he had not known that you were putting his name in the book until after.
No, I wrote to him before.
You wrote to him first.
Yes, I did.
What did he say when you wrote to
him? Well, I wrote to him. I mean, I had already put him in the book.
You had already put him in the book.
And I did this not because I wanted. I had no idea it was going to be the sensation that it's been the last few days. I did it because this was a man who was African-American, and I to a degree, wanted to show how times had changed, because if it had happened today, that part of it would not have been shocking. In those days, if it had leaked out, it would have probably cost us both our jobs.
Really.
He was also married. That was wrong. It was wrong then. It would be wrong today. And I broke it off because he was married, and he went home just before that and asked his wife for a divorce because I couldn't continue to see him since he was married. And I didn't do it because isn't this a juicy story? I did it to say, first of all, he was important in my life at the time. I write also about Alan Greenspan and John Warner. People haven't asked me about them because even though they're brilliant and accomplished, you know, it's not as shocking a story. But it was a very different time, and I wanted people to understand. And since I was going to tell the story, I was going to tell the whole story. I did write and tell him that it was going to be in the book. I think if he had written back and said, please don't, I still would have had time to take it out. He didn't. He wrote a very nice note. I won't give you the contents of it, but he knew that it was coming out. And he has a wife whom I didn't know now. He remarried. I hear she's lovely. I'm sure it's a very good marriage.
He's 88 years old.
He's 88, yes.
Here's an email from Steve in St. Louis, who says, I think Ms. Walters was wrong in naming the individual she had an affair with. I am a man in my 70s, and to this day, I would not disclose anyone I was with.
I understand that. I mean, I can see that, and this was not something that I talked about and so forth. I can totally understand that. On the other hand, I was writing the story of my life. And I did not just want it to be, I interviewed this celebrity and I interviewed that celebrity and I didn't, you know. And I think the way I talked about Senator Brooke and the other men in my life was in the most admiring way and remember it was 30 years ago. If this had happened now, I don't talk about anyone now. This was a long time ago.
Do you think you'll ever get married again?
No, I will not get married
again. Why do you think you had three marriages that failed?
Well, first of all, in those days, you got married. You didn't live with someone. And I hadn't thought about that, Diane, until just, I wish I'd said that before.
Long time ago.
If you were with someone and you didn't live with them, you know, you got married.
Right.
My first marriage, I was very young, but people thought I was old. I was 23. That was old to be getting married. And it was a very brief marriage. And the other marriages had different reasons. One of them was bi-coastal. That doesn't work after a time. Both of these men were in show business with their ups and downs, which was more difficult for me than it might have been to someone else.
See, now, the one thing I'm curious about is whether those relationships might not have worked because of your relationship with your father.
I think the fear of the show business life, that these men also had their ups and downs, which for somebody else would have been very glamorous. Lee Gruber, the father of my daughter, invested in Broadway shows. People loved that. I lived in fear. Where's money going to come from? What if the show is a flop? I didn't have the same feeling that others might have had. But on the other hand, I chose these men. So there obviously was something in it that I could relate to. But again, I married Lee Gruber right after the assassination of John Kennedy. I think a lot of people got married that way. And I hadn't thought of that until we were talking about it now.
Did you ever think you might marry Alan Greenspan?
No, I was. I just saw Andrea Mitchell earlier this morning.
What
she's
a dear
great
person!
Friend and yeah. Talk about working hard.
Right.
No, I really didn't want to get married when I got. Marriage was not something that I yearned for. And Alan was wonderful to me when I left NBC and went to ABC, and it was such a difficult time. He was wise and he was kind. Alan didn't want to get married until he met Andrea, you know. So, no, I don't think we talked about marriage.
What's your life like now? What's your sort of daily schedule?
Well,
I know you're on book tour,
well,
but I mean...
Right now, this is not normal.
Right.
I think that my life has never been as good. I mean, it would have been... would have been nicer if it were, you know, 20 years ago, but I wouldn't have had this 20 years ago. I was too ambitious. I was still auditioning. My daughter is fine and happy. That's the most important thing. You know that saying, you're only as happy as your unhappiest child? Well, my child is happy. I have many friends. I love my life now. I still work. I still do specials. I do 10 Most Fascinating People. I do Academy Award Night, and I will continue to work. And I do radio now, as you pointed out. I will continue to work for a while, but I have stopped auditioning.
You really have.
Mm-hmm. Although one reporter said to me, if Osama bin Laden called, what would you do? And I said, I would pack and be on the next plane.
Of course
but
you
yes,
would.
I am at peace. Not everyone can say that. And that's one of the reasons that I could write this kind of a book.
Yeah, 20 years ago, you could not have done this.
No.
You weren't at that point of peace with yourself. And that's where it sounds as though you are.
I am at this point. Now, look, you know, would it be nice to have shared a marriage for 50 years, you know, as you have? Yes, but I didn't. No one has everything. And I am so blessed. And when I see when people, women say, oh, you paved the way, I didn't do it deliberately. I wasn't waving a flag. I wasn't stomping my feet. Mostly I just worked and didn't whine. But what a reward that is to look at all of the women now on television, in front of the cameras, behind the cameras, and to feel, not just in television, but to feel maybe I made a difference. I mean, what a reward.
Barbara Walters, what a delight to not only talk with you, but to read this book and to understand the whole picture. Barbara Walters, the book is titled Audition, a Memoir. I hope to see you again.
I'm honored to have you interview me, You're a legend, and you pave the way, too. It's my great pleasure to have been here.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
That was Diane's 2008 interview with Barbara Walters. She died in December at age 93. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brumberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by me, Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thank you for listening. See you next week.